the curses which Islam lays on its votaries, besides the fanatical frenzy, which is as dangerous in a man as hydrophobia in a dog, there is this fearful, fatalistic apathy. The effects are apparent in many countries. Improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, and insecurity of property exist wherever the followers of the Prophet Muhammad rule or live. A degraded sensualism deprives this life of its grace and refinement, and the next of its dignity and sanctity. The fact that in Islamic law, every woman must belong to some man as his absolute property, either as a wife, a child, or a concubine, must delay the final extinction of slavery until the faith of Islam has ceased to be a great power amongst men. Individual Muslims may show splendid qualities, but the influence of the Islamic religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in this world, and far from it being moribund, Islamism is a militant and proselytizing faith. It has already spread throughout Central Africa, raising fearless warriors at every step. And were it not that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arms of science, the science against which Islam has vainly struggled, the civilization of modern Europe might fall, as fell the civilization of ancient Rome.
This is MR Radio, I'm GW, and my guest today is the owner of that voice and the leader of the British political party, Liberty GB, Paul Weston. Paul, welcome to MR Radio. It's very good indeed to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Look, Paul, we'll get down straight away to the first question. It's a standard question. It's the one which gives us the opportunity to learn about where you're coming from. I hadn't heard of you in the nationalist movement until you shot into the picture as the leader of the British Freedom Party. What was your own personal history before that and your awakening to the whole issue? How did that come about?
Well, I suppose really 20 years ago, I think it wasn't so much a sort of nationalist viewpoint 20 years ago, but I was very much aware that the whole political correctness madness was going on and was trying to get my head around why we seem to be intent as a country and a culture on committing suicide, basically. So I started reading from a very small selection of books at the time, and that then went on until the internet, of course, started.
Yes.
But I suppose it was 2004, 2005 when it really took off, and I was intending to write a book. The title of which was National Suicide, The Insanity of Liberal Britain. And I needed research, and I was looking around for research on it, and I couldn't really find it. And I went onto the internet and looked up various sort of titles, and I ended up looking for a generic search on conservative books. And I put in conservativebookclub.co.uk, and I got stuff on Palmerston and Disraeli and Margaret Thatcher. So I thought, oh, this is no bloody use at all. And I just changed the .co.uk for .com and suddenly discovered Pat Buchanan and, there are hundreds and hundreds of books written in America about contemporary politics attacking liberalism. And I became an absolute book fiend. I bought hundreds of them and devoured them, at all hours of the day and night. I can't even read one anymore. I've simply been filled up to such an extent. I've been saturated. So I read Dick Francis at night now. But for years, I read those. And then I started to write. And initially, it was like a lot of people, like I think yourself, leaving comments on other sites. And my principal site I was leaving comments at was Lawrence Auster's View from the Right in America. And he started putting my comments up, and you had to leave a good comment for Lawrence Auster to put it up. And I can remember the absolute thrill that I had when I first went up on one of his pages. And it was the incident shortly after that, I can't remember what year it was, but the Undercover Mosques program.
Channel 4.
Yes, and I West wrote Woodland, something. Please. Yes, exactly. I wrote something about that and sent it off to, I think I sent it off to Jihad Watch and Gates of Vienna and another couple of sites, and Gates of Vienna posted it and said they liked it, and so I started writing those sort of articles from then on, and that slowly eventually morphed into actually getting involved politically rather than just blogging.
Right, so you didn't come from a religious background, a Christian background, anything?
No, not at all, not at all.
No, and you describe yourself then as just being a regular guy with a good education and with a writing capacity and a curious mind, which is a pretty killing combination when you're thinking about what kind of people actually might change the world we're living in. That's the sort, in my opinion. We need a lot more of them.
We certainly do.
Okay, so you're awake at this point. You have an input into the whole subject matter through the sort of Jihad Watch style, Gates of Vienna style of blog. It's quite a narrow input, and as we all know, it's not necessarily one that's respected universally. At what point did you become political? What made you decide to do that, and how did you go about it?
Well, it was actually with UKIP. You know, I was brought up in a conservative household.
Yeah, likewise.
The idea that the Conservatives could be behaving the way that they were was quite repellent to me. In sort of 2009, I became involved with UKIP. So, you know, only because they were doing and saying things that I thought the Conservatives should be saying. So I actually stood for UKIP in the 2010 election for the cities of London and Westminster. And I doubled the vote from 300 votes to 600 votes. But I can remember in my interview with them, I said, look, you know, 2010 is a complete waste of time for UKIP. You know, your time will come in the 2015 elections. I have no doubt about it at all. It was Lord Pearson was leader at the time, and he was the guy that got Geert Wilders over into the House of Lords to scream the fiddler.
He was quite radical, Pearson, in his way.
He was. He was.
But not a political leader.
No, not a political leader at all. But at least he had the balls to actually stand up and talk about the whole Islamic side of it. And when Farage came back in again, Islam was just off the table completely, as was, you know, Farage is very good at criticizing Poles and Lithuanians and Latvians, but not so brave when it comes to criticizing Asians and Africans. So.
No.
No, so I thought, well, UKIP's a dead duck as far as I'm concerned. And then I was approached by a chap called George Whale, who was part of the splinter group from the BNP that was the British Freedom Party.
Yes.
And asked me to come in and take it over, which I did. It could have gone a great deal better, but you know, when you take something over, you're a sort of token figurehead, basically. And the people that had set it up were not really prepared to give up the reins of power.
This is Lee John Barnes who'd set it up, isn't it?
Yes, it was Lee John Barnes, Peter Mullins and Simon Bennett. And the whole thing became sort of untenable. So I left, and again with George Whale, we ditched that side of the people involved and started another party, Liberty GB. I think, like all these things in politics, like UKIP in 2010, their time was not right, and our time is not yet right. But I have no doubt it will come about.
Okay, you've managed to introduce the ethnocentric element, particularly in terms of numbers, the growth of the non-native, non-indigenous population. So that's given you another in. I'm just wondering whether you feel that makes you a strict nationalist and you are competing really with the BNP. Have you managed to escape that to some extent, or are you now in it?
Well, I suppose we are in it. You know, when I started out, because British Freedom, I think this was specifically down to Lee John Barnes, wanted to talk about cultural nationalism.
Yes.
And I was thinking at the time that look, you know, I don't have a party of my own. I don't know anybody. This is a perfectly good vehicle for me. When it all split up and we set up Liberty GB, George Whale, who I could not do without in terms of organization, he had still not come round to the ethno-nationalist side of things. Not because he knew about it and but was still against it. He didn't really know enough about it. And we've had various drunken conversations after meetings. And after a few of those, he came round, at which point we specifically said, look, you know, we are no longer cultural nationalists. We are nationalist, ethno-nationalist. You know, our country is in danger. Our people means culture. So that is really, I think I've always been that person. It was just finding people that could support me that would accept that as well. And I think we have now reached that point, which is a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so you're now running much closer to where the BNP is. You've both got constraints in terms of what the law allows you to say, so you can't turn into a straightforward party for white people. You're not allowed to do that anymore. That's since 2010 Equalities Act, I think. Do you feel that you can drive forward a broadly ethno-nationalist party at this moment, or do you think that there are still too many problems with access to the press or political correctness and the aggression of the anti-racist left and so on? Is it becoming more possible for you to speak, or is it becoming, or is it remaining still very, very dangerous and difficult?
I think there are yes, it is difficult. I don't know that it's dangerous, but
you nearly got locked up, so I mean that's pretty.
Yes, but I think that's all par for the course. I think if you're taking this sort of political route, but what I do think is that we have a huge problem that you don't see in France or Italy or Germany or America or Canada, in that our middle class seem to be totally cowed by political correctness and by this whole thing. So our support is 90% working class, because they are obviously the people primarily affected. But we don't have the sympathetic middle classes they seem to have in their droves in other countries coming out to support them. And until we get the middle class, which of course is Middle England, we are never going to make that much progress. And the only way we will get Middle England is if we can get into the mainstream media.
Do I think that if there is a Labour government, you can make more progress with a working class base? I think that the BNP successes up to 2009 do demonstrate that advances can be made from the left under those circumstances. But certainly when you've got a Conservative government or something close to a Conservative government we have now, I wouldn't mean Conservative as a descriptive, of course, it's just the just the title. I think it's very difficult for any nationalist party at all, operating from a traditional nationalist basis, to actually break in. It's almost as though the ball has been seized by these other guys and they're not going to let you have it and play with it. But when the Labour Party's got it, they got the ball at their feet and you can always take it off them. And this is what the BNP managed to do. And they did do incredibly well. I mean, if you can imagine from where you are now, getting two MPs elected to the European Parliament, it's absolutely an enormous step forward. It's only 5% of the vote, but it was an enormous step forward, and it produced a lot of potential, which promptly got thrown away by them, by Mr. Griffin, which is another story. But, you know, I think that if you've got a Miliband in power, particularly if you've got Miliband in power, because it's going to be a very inefficient government with lots of opportunities arising from that inefficiency, then you might find with your base that you'll be able to do something with the right kind of approach and the right kind of discourse.
Well, a political party is so different to building up a large following on a website, for example. Simply because you have to have regional organizers. You have to have people that will do the work and organize. And, you know, every few months I get this thing through the letterbox from the Countryside Alliance, you know, the pro fox hunting people. Yeah. And I look at it and I think, God almighty,
how do they do that?
Yeah, what I would do to have people like that organizing on, you know, for this. They've got printers and designers and just this glossy professional thing drops through your letterbox. It's full of adverts, so they're making a great deal of money out of it as well. And until we have a certain caliber of people that can organize things efficiently, we are never going to get to a a competitive political party status. You know, when I go back to my days in UKIP on this, I used to go to the West London UKIP thing once a month, and it was boring. It was dowdy. It was above a pub, but they did it, and the woman that was organising it did it every month, come rain or shine, and relentlessly across the country, hundreds and hundreds of people like that have made UKIP what it is. You know, forget all this crap about, you know, Farage has made UKIP. All of those little people around the country doing their little bit in every single area have enabled UKIP to do that. And we, as yet, don't have that. We've got people who are tremendously hardworking, but they're not really, as yet, organisers. The BNP, of course, did it. You know, they've lost it now, but they had a nationwide structure that as you say, Griffin sort of just ballsed up completely. But you know, it was there, and it was there to be utilised, and it just wasn't.
Well, can you attract the demographic that you're after? These middle class, educated, committed people. If you're offering basically sort of a negative analysis, I mean, just looking at your famous YouTube offerings, I've got a few of them up on screen, the average sort of fairly anonymous offering knocks up about 7,000 at present time, of course it'll go up, but knocks up about 7,000 views. Then we get to the racism of the left. There's one here which has 11,000 views, nearly. Suddenly we get to preventing white genocide. White genocide is an emotive phrase. It touches on Americans as well. 39,000. But of course, the king of them all is I am a racist. 285,000 on this particular recording, and I believe there's more than one of those on the net. So you've got quite a large output there, but the fact remains that what you're saying fundamentally is, oh look, this is terrible, look at our numbers, we're dying, this is terrible, we've got to do something about it, we've only got 30-40 years before it's going to get very, very bad, on one side, and on the other you're saying, oh golly, well, Islam's a horrific thing, just look at the nature of it, what's it going to be like for our children, da, 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 da. And these are negative messages. And I'm just wondering whether people who have a middle-class outlook on life need something, and this is difficult to do, I'm not saying it's easy, but something more positive to rally around than that. If you look at conservatism is not a philosophy at all, but it offers a vision of freedom, very clear vision of freedom and of individuality, and these are things which people can, prosperity and so on, these are people which can identify with, their positives. So, I mean, the great question is, it's not just for you, but for everybody who's involved in this, is what are the positives that we're offering?
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, it is a very negative message, but I think it's also down to a time frame. First of all, people have to be aware of the real situation today. And very few people I speak to, you know, outside of our political sphere, very few of them have got the faintest idea about how bad it is today, let alone how bad it's going to be given another couple of generations. No. So I think, you know, I think at the moment that you need to open eyes, you need to give them facts and figures, you need to project it forward into the future. And it is negative, but at the same time you're saying, look, if you don't want your children to, you know, to live a life like this, then you need to start doing something about it now and do something about it politically now. How do you dress that up into a positive? I don't know. You know, my only positive really is, you know, is to say we will enable your children to live in peace and prosperity, which they will not do otherwise.
I mean, you were talking about Lee's cultural approach. I mean, there are positives in a cultural analysis. Obviously there's a defensive reason for it existing, that kind of approach. But nonetheless, as an approach in itself, it is talking about you know, what unifies people, what people love, what people are connected to, as well as their own children and their own people. But the cultural thing did have that to some extent. I talked to Lee once, and you know, he was giving me all this and saying how much power it had got because of this. And I think he's broadly right that when we're trying to change public discourse, it's a good thing to say, well, you know, this is what we've created, this is what we made, and we did this for our children. This is the mother lode of Western civilization. This is what we need to protect and hand on. And so I think the cultural thing does have some value. The only problem with it is that if it's followed strictly, and if you are going to deny, as Lee was, denying the ethnic basis, against his own beliefs, I might add, but anyway, denying the ethnic basis of what, you know, what really matters, then you can bring yourself to the position where you're saying, well, all we need to do is to unite around some ideas, and all of our brothers and sisters of all kinds and colours can all be sort of united together happily around this this concept of why don't we all assimilate, and that won't help at all. It's the fastest road to perdition, in fact. So, you know, I think there's something positive in the cultural analysis that perhaps you might go back and visit.
Well, no, I think you're probably right. I think the idea of that is to specifically say, look, this is who we are, and what wonderful things we have done, and what wonderful things we have taken to the rest of the world.
Yes,
and you know, do it as a cultural phenomenon, but do not end up at the end of it saying that all you have to do is become like us, no matter where you're from, and we can all live happily ever after. I think we can do the cultural thing, but say, look, it's our cultural thing, and we intend to keep it that way.
Mm. I think there's a lot more that could be done with that. I mean, I've noticed, you know, when I blog at the Telegraph, one of the questions that is always, well, not a question, it's an assertion that's always put, is that, you know, well, you English, you don't really exist, and it doesn't really matter what happens, whatever. I mean, you know, you've done all these bad things, and to hell with you, sort of thing. And one of the replies I give to that is to list some of the achievements, just of the English, Scots, and Welsh, you know, about inventing America and the Antipodes, inventing modernity, all three industrial, well, the agricultural industrial revolution and the internet revolution is in large part invented by Englishmen. And, you know, you put this whole thing across to them and say that, well, the thing is that that then tends to receive quite a large number of recommends from readers. So there are people out there who recognize that. They're proud of that. They're saying, yeah, yeah, there is something. Yeah, yeah, nobody else has done that. That's us. And this is a positive message. And if I was involved in politics, where I couldn't speak about, and may not even be particularly profitable, to speak about what really matters, which is, you know, genes, blood, ethnicity, survival and continuity of the people, that's what really counts, I would seize on that, and I would try to work it as hard as I could, I think. And you're in a position to do that.
No, I think you're right, and I think it is very much something that needs to be done. I actually roughed something out for a speech a few weeks ago on precisely because of what you're saying, so that when one of these bastards comes up on a Telegraph site and says, well, what is British culture, or what is English culture, you can say, listen, I don't have enough time to explain it to you. Go and look at this video.
Yes. Yes. Well, they don't do that. They won't click on it. I mean, I put lots of video links on for people, but I know they don't click on them because I leave the page up and I watch the numbers, refresh and see if there's anybody, you know, arrived. And links don't get clicked on very often. I would say very, very few actually do that. Maybe it's because they're a bit frightened of whether there's some little package at the end of that that's going to infect their computer or something, or attract the attention of the security services.
Aren't they frightening, these people who, you know, who actually come up? And, you know, most of these ones are probably not foreigners, they're English.
Oh, yes.
Actually saying this, because, you know, to delegitimize a people is the very first step you have to take before you start moving on to the next stage. Exactly.
Yes, and they know this, and they don't care. One of the other things that is interesting, because obviously one of the things we do is to point out that actually it isn't racist in any way, shape or form for any people to defend its own existence. How on earth can that be morally inadmissible? You know, providing its proportionate response, it's impossible. I mean, if you don't allow people to defend their existence, then basically you are disqualifying the right of self-defense. And of course, if you're doing that on a selective basis, i.e. because the people concerned have white skin, when you would never dream of doing it to a people that did not have white skin, then you are indeed the racist. Well, now I notice they're trying to find ways and means of addressing this stuff, and it's obviously causing a certain amount of disquiet. I do think that some of them work together. They do also seem to have, because presumably some of these are paid, we know that the EU pays them, and I think it's reasonable to assume that the Labour Party and Conservative Party does so. I don't think that the Lib Dems would have the energy to do that. But, you know, they do seem to have shifts, and they come on in pairs and at different times. So somebody will stay on for 6 or 7 hours and disappear, then somebody, another couple come on. It's much more organised than one thinks.
But none of them are very bright, are they? They cannot put a very good argument up ever. And of course they can't put an argument up because, you know, because morally and intellectually we are right and they are wrong.
But it's pathetic. I mean, I've had discussions with a guy who claims to be a geneticist and another one with a guy who claims to be a biologist. And on their own subjects, I've wiped the floor with them. And I'm neither a geneticist or a biologist, simply because at some point they have to start telling lies because everything inside their worldview has been subjugated to their politics.
Mm.
And their politics is a lie.
Exactly. One of the ones you can get them on, of course, is their view on colonization. You know, was it a good thing for us to colonize the rest of the world? And of course, they say no.
Yeah.
So why do you think it is a good thing for white people to be colonized by brown people? You know, it's simply down to the color of someone's skin as to whether you agree with it or not, which of course makes you fundamentally a racist.
Yes.
Now you can get them on this one all the time.
Yes. You do very well, actually, Paul. I would love to know I must check it one of these days, what your average number of recommends per comment is. It must be hugely high because you're quite often, when you come in early enough, you're quite often the top, the best rated comment. So, you know, you must do quite well for yourself out of that. I think that a lot of people automatically click on you just because you got arrested once and they recognise you're a good guy and, you know, you're fighting on the right side. They probably don't even finish reading it, but the fact is you do immensely well out of that, and you do need to connect that as much as you can with your party so that people understand who this is.
You're right about that, but I very rarely, if ever, mention Liberty GB on the Telegraph site because I just don't think it is it's not the right place for me to be advertising my party. You know, I will go there and argue my point, and if some people crop up and say, "Well done, Paul," I'm a fan of Liberty GB. I will acknowledge it.
That's the answer. You want to get somebody behind you to come in and yeah, one of the guys in the party, just to let him know I'm going to be doing this. Will you? You know, but it's worthwhile doing. I mean, you think how many. Platforms are there in which you can actually go online, post something without moderation initially, not pre-moderation, be now almost as free speaking as you like. There aren't that many.
No, yeah. That's true. I mean, really, it's the Telegraph, Breitbart. The Times is behind a paywall, so that's no good.
That's no good. No, Sun is gone. You know, the Daily Mail is impossible. Because it's in fact, obviously, a lot of people do work on the Mail in terms of trying to develop a political platform for us. But I've never get a comment posted on that. I can't get one through.
No, you know, and there's the hijacking of the Telegraph comments, which I think's only happened in the last sort of month or so, where I'm not sure who they are. They've got a variety of names. Everhardus is one of them.
Oh, these guys, yeah.
Yeah, you know, especially on the Dan Hodges things.
There's about a dozen of them from different sources. But there are all kinds of little collectives of people who are operating on there loosely. And I think that you could probably identify half a dozen different constituencies. And certainly Majority Rights has had a constituency which has been operating on there. loosely, but we know roughly who we are, I think, and we've done something. I reckon that we've done a lot overall, if you put all of our efforts together, not just MR, but I mean everybody involved, all the nationalists involved, to change the nature of the Telegraph completely as an environment in which people can speak. We've made it possible to speak much more freely than the owners of the medium want.
Mm.
And, you know, all praise to them, really, for not shutting it down as Murdoch has.
No, exactly. And I think it is a fantastic medium for us to be involved in, because so many, you know, there are millions of people out there. A lot of them will read the Daily Telegraph, and a minority of them will read the articles with the comments. But they're looking at a nice, safe, conservative newspaper. You know, they're not going offline and online.
No, not into the Badlands. No.
Exactly. And, you know, and how do you find a site like Majority Rights, you know, unless you're sort of directed to it?
Well, that's right. That's right. The fact remains that the Telegraph is a highly conservative paper, and the readership is, or certainly the online readership, is really very, very supportive of UKIP. Let's talk about them. They've made this immense breakthrough over the last couple of years. It's very clear that the political establishment feels at risk, so it should. How do you see the general development through 2015? What are your expectations for the election?
Well, I think 2015 is... a lot of people are saying Farage is going to become prime minister. Well, you know, of course he isn't. He is the kingmaker in this election, you know, without a shadow of a doubt. And what interests me is the fact the Conservatives initially were terrified of UKIP because it was their vote being stolen by the UKIP people. But the whole immigration thing has now come to factoring in the traditional Labour voters who are having to live in the hellholes created by mass immigration. Yep. And I was at a EDL thing recently, and some bloke there was from Stoke-on-Trent, and he said everybody he knew was going to vote UKIP. And I said, presumably none of them are Conservative voters in the past. He said, no, they are all Labour voters, which is a shame, really, because that takes away an element of Farage's king-making potential, because if it was only the Conservative vote he was eating into, he could quite easily do a deal with Cameron and say, look, you know, I am going to lose you the next election. You need to do something for you to win it, which basically would be, well, an immediate, within 3 months of the election, a referendum on Europe. And at that point, UKIP are blown out of the water. They're finished. They're gone. There is no point to their existence anymore. And Cameron, if he wanted to, could do that. But I think that, unfortunately, it's going to be a case now that because Labour are losing the vote as well, neither party will do any sort of accommodation with UKIP. And whoever ends up winning will win, with UKIP probably coming ahead of the Lib Dems, but coming in third.
I think the problem UKIP have, they can pick up the vote, but it's spread evenly across the countryside, and that's not how you win seats.
No, it's not, and also it's the, you know, it is the numbers involved still. You know, I think that if you rolled forward to 2020, even without Farage saying anything further than he is now, you know his little hints about immigration, his little hints about being on a train and didn't really hear any English accents. Yeah. I mean, the guy is such a slippery little specimen, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, either come out and say it, or that even if he doesn't, he's given people the tremendous hope, is all it is, that he is going to do something about it. And you see this in all the comments in the newspapers. You know, Farage is going to sort everything out for us.
Well, he's going to control, but, I mean, to control is no good. And in fairness, I mean, in your... and you know this, Paul, because you've produced that white genocide video which talked about the numbers, but on your own website, Statement of Ideology, point number 2 promises that Indigenous British will remain in perpetual majority, and you're talking about the maintaining the ratio at its present levels, which is, if you take us being something between, say, 75 and 78 90% indigenous. This is about where we are officially now. But if you start thinking about what it might be in reality, because of the complete lack of control over getting a proper number, it might be a lot worse than that.
But, well, even if nothing changes, if there was no more immigration today, though, you know, that figure is going to considerably worse.
Exactly.
But, you know, because we are the declining. Indigenous Brits are old and yes. we're dying, and yes. so our 75% is not a true reflection.
The true
reflection is what you see in the schools in the cities.
The true reflection is a function of the numbers of women of fertile age. And their fertility rate. That is actually the vital issue, modified to some extent, badly obviously from our point of view, by emigration of our people, by race mixing, which ends family lines for keeps, and by other structural factors, which are
exactly.
From ongoing immigration, there are structural factors within the non-white sector particularly, which are increasing their numbers anyway, spousal importation.
And it's this one thing that people don't seem to be able to get their heads around, that if you look at the demographic of the over 80-year-olds, I imagine white indigenous Brits are 99.9%.
Yeah, it's a huge percentage.
But you go down to the under 10s, and we're 60%?
Something like that, yeah.
You give that one more generation, you know. Yeah. And we're seeing it happen already in America, where newborn babies are now, whites are now the minority.
But to return to my point, I mean, you know, your statement of ideology does not say, but it is, if you're going to be literal about this, that you, to hold the ratio, you've got to make deep, ongoing cuts in the numbers of non-Indigenous in the country, if it is the ratio you're going to seek to hold.
Well, I think there are certain things you can say and certain things you can't say. I think that if Joe Bloggs is looking at our website, they will not be too horrified to see that.
No.
But you know, in terms of talking to people of the same mind, then, you know, clearly we have to start looking, if one was in power, you would have to start looking at repatriation quite clearly.
So what do you think would actually happen if Farage was able at some point, or maybe Farage's successor, was able to perform the function that the Liberals perform today, keep Miliband out, you know, and, you know, realism took hold of the Conservatives and they said, well, we've got no other choice but to go into opposition. What are we going to do? I mean, can you see that actually happening? Can you see it changing the ground at all?
I think that it is a distinct possibility that Cameron is going to have to do a deal with him. And it would be 5 years of a coalition, as you describe it, where Farage gets to make some little tweaks to it. Possibly 5 years after that, Farage might be able to come to power. But if he did come to power in 2020, having had a fairly ineffectual 5 years as a coalition, junior coalition partner, Farage in power in 2020 would do absolutely bugger all about sorting this country out. Yes, we'd be out of the European Union. Yes, we would have proper fixed rules and requirements about coming in. But he would still be letting in third world people, now, admittedly educated ones who are coming in to fill a job. But you know, it's still the third world. Mm. They're still going to come in. He is certainly not going to send anybody out. Now, this is the problem that as he is getting closer to a powerful, not to power, but to a more powerful position, he's got people like Douglas Carswell coming into the party who say things like, you know, I don't like some of the angry nativism of some of the UKIP. They're right. Yes. You know, the more of these Carswells that come into the party, the bigger UKIP will get, the bigger media attraction it will get, the more powerful it will become, but it's also at the same time destroying itself.
Then one of two things will happen. They will either blow up and cease to be electable, or there'll be a split in the party. There will be a new form of dissent, and that dissent would have to take the basis of a genuine ethnocentric rebellion.
Yes, it would, because at the moment, all the people that I knew in UKIP from 2010 and earlier, all of them were anti the European Union. A handful of them were sort of hung up on the whole immigration side of it. And that, you know, there immediately is your split. And as it gets bigger, that will become more and more obvious.
But for the people, I mean, there's this piece I read this morning. I can't remember what paper it was in, online paper. But for the people, the major issue is immigration. And in fact, I remember some research by YouGov probably 3 years ago now, which showed that something like 70-odd% of UKIP's own voters named immigration as the number one issue. This was sort of, they had multi-choices. About 72% picked the economy, and these two were one and two by a mile. The EU was about 30%.
Mm.
So, you know, that's the balance.
The economy is interesting, because if you look at something like Golden Dawn in Greece, you know, you need to have a failing economy before you start getting real nationalism. As far as I'm concerned, it seems obvious that that the banks were not bailed out. They were simply given loads of printed money. You know, nothing has changed, except we're even further in debt than we were, you know, in 2008. Yeah. And this is not just here. It's a global situation, and we are going to hit the rocks at some point. And when that happens, that will suddenly become a huge driving force to a nationalist party. When people are hungry, they suddenly discover that they are English before anything else.
It's interesting, economically speaking, that one of the more radical voices in UKIP was Godfrey Bloom. There was a discussion, I think it was a discussion document or something, which got released at some point, not too long ago, in which he had said, well, look, we've got to start talking at least about the principles involved in bank reform, the fiat issue, and all this sort of thing. You know, as soon as you start talking about that, then the establishment is going to come at you and get you by the throat, because that is their holy grail. You know, you can hammer on about immigration, and they could cope if they lost the immigration battle. They can cope if they lost the EU battle up to a point. They'll find another way of working around that. But what they can't cope with is having the financials attacked. That's what they exist for. That's what they're owned by, you know. That's what they're obedient to. That's what they ultimately, that is their holy grail. This preservation of the financial system.
Yeah.
This is what they work for. Simple as that.
Absolutely right. You know, everybody I speak to seems to think that interest rates in this country are as low as they are because inflation is low. Well, that's absolute bollocks. Inflation is manipulated. The reason that they're so low is because the government owes 1.4 trillion quid. Now, they cannot afford for that to have high interest rates.
I think it's 1.7, isn't it? That's a huge, huge, I mean, unimaginable amount of money. And in fact, the interest...
Well, you know, right now, 30% of the annual tax revenue goes on paying interest on our national debt.
Is it really? I didn't imagine it was high as that. 30%.
It's astonishing. And of course, it's going up every year.
Yeah, but we're not going to be able to do anything about that until there's a real maturation of the public debate. It's very difficult for people to understand, and for at least, I would say, two-thirds of them, they will never understand it. They'll just forget about it and won't bother to think.
Nope.
But it is where, ultimately, the contest is hottest. There's no question of that. So, just looking at public attitudes hardening in our direction over the next few years, how far can public attitudes be politicized? When I know that understanding is one thing, but an awful lot of people who understand it now but don't want to do anything about it, they haven't been politicized about it for whatever reason. What can one do to actually politicize them?
Well, you can keep on putting the message out, but I think No, it isn't enough. But luckily for us, we have the Muslim problem. If Muslims weren't going around blowing people up and doing all the things that they're doing, and they were just quietly going to the mosque and quietly going home again afterwards,
it would be difficult.
Yeah, you know, we would wake up in 2030 or 2040 to find that that's it. We've lost. It's all over. it is an absolute godsend from Allah for us to have the Muslims behave as they do, because they are drawing attention to the situation all the time. And the Muslim demographic will double between now and 2025. Right. I know that I've said this many times before and it's boring, but when you only have 200,000 Muslims in 1970 that become 400,000, it doesn't really matter because no one notices. When you've got 3 or 4 million becoming 8 million by 2025, it's such a huge increase that everybody will notice. And we've seen what happens when they reach certain percentages. They become more aggressive, more violent, more.
You can't familiarize yourself to it.
No, and they will get through. We have heard recently that something like 4 or 5 in the last month alone attacks have been stopped in Britain. That at some point one will get through, and you get 1, 2, 3 getting through a year, people's patience will completely snap. And 2025, I think, will be a time for a nationalist party to come to power in this country. It won't be 2020. It might be UKIP in 2020, going the way they're going now, but it will not be a proper nationalist party. 2025, it will be. 2030, right. Absolutely.
But I just say that if it's not by 2025, I think that politics might be forsaken by a number of people and other direct means.
I was just about to say that. My final bit there was after that, it won't be down to men in suits and political parties anymore.
No. And this is the most terrible thing about it all, that we are not listened to as it is, but we are, in fact, the people who are trying to avert this terrible future. The likelihood of there being a peaceful resolution to all this, you're talking about, in essence, the killing of the European race, and it's supplanting by Africans and Asians, who themselves are most hostile to one another. The chances of this being a peaceful process are pretty much zero, I would submit. And we are the ones, reviled as we are, who are doing the honourable thing of pointing this out. To move on to the next question. Obviously, you have absolutely no interest in talking to the BNP. They wouldn't want to talk to you at this point. But do you think that there is any basis at all on which this immensely disparate form that nationalism in this country is currently taking politically, do you think there is any basis at all on bringing people together, on finding a common standard around which they can unite? And would it be Liberty GB?
Clearly, I would like it to be Liberty GB. I think that one of the problems with the BNP, someone the other day said, supposing the BNP approached you to take over as leader. Yeah. And I said, what I would like is all of the BNP people to come over to Liberty GB. But I could not take over the BNP simply because the name has been dragged through the mud and is now... it's radioactive. BNP is radioactive. You cannot get any change out of that at all. Griffin destroyed that whole thing to such a degree that it's muddied, it's besmirched, it's stained. So in terms of taking it over, no, I certainly couldn't do that. Whether people would come over from the BNP to us, I don't know. It would be nice if they did. We have some.
Well, the BNP's only probably got somewhere in the region of 3,000 members today. It's got obviously a reasonable vote level of something sort of around about 3%, probably 4% tops. You might get an occasional possibility of a decent vote in some of the wards, but basically it's a shadow of where it was when the membership leak occurred, which would have been what, about 2009-ish. There was 10,500 odd members, I think.
Well, I think at their peak they had 16,000.
Right, and I was going to say I thought that they had actually got about 14,000, but 16—that's a tremendous achievement for a nationalist party. And you have to say, well, okay, all of those people, they haven't changed their opinion. They haven't suddenly become good liberals or anti-racists. So they're still there. It was rumoured, certainly I think it was stated by people who were in the know, that something of the order of 75% of BNP activists, senior activists, organisers, were thrown out of the party in that period after 2009, after the Question Time debacle, up to the challenge by Andrew Bronze for the leadership, so a period of about a year and a half, I suppose. And during that time, there was a huge bleeding of senior people in the party. Well, they haven't gone away. Some of them went into other parties, of which there is a large number, but they've not gone away, and every single one of those, I think, would want nothing more than there to be a effective national party to which they could contribute again, which would be, you know, developing beyond the point where the BNP had actually got to. So, you know, this is something that's very important, I think, in terms of taking the argument forward. And if we're looking ahead and saying, well, at some point, you know, UKIP are going to probably split along the lines that you indicated, to have that mass there working as one and saying this is the place to rally around, this is the place to generate your politics from, is very, very important. We do need that.
We do need it.
I don't think there's a hope in hell of it being the BNP again. You know, I'm hoping in due course that we might talk to Adam Walker and get his view on this whole thing. But I think he's got the most immense job on his hand to rebuild that back up again. Even, you know, with Miliband's help and a Labour Party in place, I think it would be very, very difficult for them to recover that sort of ground.
No,
extremely hostile. So
I agree. And I think
so it's got to be somebody else.
I think it comes down to, you know,
it can't be the National Front.
No, it can't. And I don't know how many micro-parties there are out there. And Liberty GB is very much a micro-party.
Yes.
But
yes.
I think what is going to happen, you will...
But you're the only one with a profile. I suppose British... What is it, Jim Dowson? I don't know what he...
Well, Jim Dowson is sort of effectively retired now, but Britain First is,
you
know, Britain First is very much a Facebook thing. Now, they don't have the numbers that that their Facebook likes suggest. But I think the only way it will work is natural selection, and there will be all these little tiny parties, and then the moment one has become noticeably bigger, others will then join the bigger one, and that will then... self-perpetuate. At the moment, that hasn't happened, but it has to happen. You know, it's like when people build a shopping centre. You know, they get Marks and Spencers in as the anchor tenant, and everybody says, "Oh, well, if Marks and Spencers is there,
we'll
then you know, then we, you know, little tie rack will go in there as well." And we need, we Liberty GB needs to become the party that other people start coalescing around and joining. And it will be very much a natural selection. It might not be us. If another party is doing considerably better than us, I would have absolutely no hesitation in saying, right, I will fold Liberty GB and come in with you. You know, I'm not doing this for an egotistical thing. I'm doing it very much against my will, to be honest with you, but nobody else seems to have either the inclination or the ability to do it, and someone's got to do it.
Well, I think that you would do a damn good job of this, and I think that you would do justice to a much larger organisation, Paul. I think that's clear. Now, Daniel is with us online, and I know he's got a question to put to you.
It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that what we're doing here is defending native European interests and their discrete nationalist kinds. I've learned, to my satisfaction, and I think a lot of nationalists as well, that interest group does not include Jewish people, that they're not considered native Europeans. Our interest groups are something different, and that they may be... With UKIP, you seem to understand that this is looking like something like a false opposition, like something like a... immigration in the EU is to UKIP what the Fed was to Ron Paul. And there's a plutocratic interest there that's trying to distract people. But I wonder if it might be seen that there's, together with this plutocratic interest, that there's also a Jewish interest that's trying to use...
They overlap.
But it seems that there's a way, there's a moral high ground and looking at Jewish people as if they're not native European. It's not that we want to get them because they're on the basis of some inherent evil. They're just a different people. They're not Europeans. We're advocating Europeans.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, of course, Jews are Semites, hence anti-Semitism, and Arabs are Semites. So, you know, they are not European in those terms. No, you know, I would agree with that. And you know, as you've raised the Jewish question, because I'm, you know, I'm hit on this all of the time, and I think Griffin did a particularly good job when he put out some dossier linking me to God knows how many people in the neocons in America and the Jewish interests in America, who I've never met.
That was EDL, though, wasn't it? He was really going after.
I think
because EDL were threatening at that time to develop a political party, and you were there because you were connected to the Islam thing. You know, from his point of view, he wasn't actually swiping at you, but he was fighting this possibility that somebody might, at some point, turn a quite successful street movement then into a political force that would compete with his own.
Well, yes, there was that, because Tommy Robinson and Kev Carroll, you know, came into the British Freedom Party for a brief period of time, and that is really when Griffin sort of went over the top about it. And Tommy Robinson was a Zionist, and you know, I've been labelled a Zionist over and over again. You know, I wrote one article once about Israel out of hundreds of things I've written, and I was photographed at the Holocaust Memorial, which apparently makes me a Zionist. But, you know, I recognize absolutely that there are, in terms of Marxist left-wing people, there is a large coterie of Jews involved, and that is beyond a shadow of a doubt. But in terms of, do I consider them to be a threat to this country? I think that in terms of our culture, it is a threat, because they control so many of the levers of the media. Mm-hmm. In terms of physically damaging us, I don't think they are. You know, I mean, for example, we cannot get a bank account. Liberty GB cannot get a bank account. And I don't assume this is because of Jewish interests moving against us. This is primarily down to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and their sovereign wealth funds. And they presumably have said to all of the banks here, do not give bank accounts to perceived right-wing parties.
I've never bought this notion that, you know, the Saudis are incredibly powerful and doing this, doing that. I've never bought that. I think it's just a cover. Real power in this world, real political weight in this world is not Saudi.
Okay, let's say that you're right, and it is Jewish interest trying to stop Liberty GB in its tracks.
Well,
but
not Liberty GB particularly, but how it works. But if you're setting certain,
like that. But
if you're setting certain rules, and
why specifically do you think they would be going for people who are primarily standing on an anti-Islamic issue? Because this seems to be, if it is Jewish origins, it seems to be particularly suicidal.
Paul.
I think, Paul, the theory goes as to why Jewish people would act suicidally is that this is sort of in their biological pattern as a group survival strategy, that they are not, they're just acting as they would. It's not planned by their leaders.
They're just
surviving and cannibalizing the resources that they're amongst, and then moving on after it's finished. And it's in that location. Yes, it's suicidal. But what happens is that they move on. They might be in America at one time and then move on to India after that.
You know, I think my basic point is that with the knowledge that I possess, I see clear, definite threats to this country. And if it became obvious to me that, and it very much obviously has with you that you have taken this on board, if it became obvious to me then I would say and do something about it. You know, this this whole thing with my reluctance to talk about the entire Jewish thing is not because I'm an avowed Jewish fanatic. It is simply because I at the present time don't perceive it as a threat. But having said that, if I ever did perceive it as a threat, I would be as antagonistic toward that particular group of people as I am towards the Somali Muslims.
Let's end where we began with your Churchill coup, which is the way I see it. Obviously, you're somebody who, at this stage, is forced to, but perhaps you're a natural activist anyway. You regard the activist route as being much more important than the electoral route. The electoral route is a very hard road indeed for a micro-party, and an expensive one. How did you come to actually plan the Churchill thing? And what did you expect to happen as a result of it?
Well, first of all, on the electoral and the activist side, I'm not really a natural activist at all. It's just that if you want to be recognised, you have to do something, and you cannot have any form of electoral success if people don't know who you are. So that was only a means towards hopefully one day gaining electoral success. You know, we have to become a household name, and in terms of doing it, I was talking a couple of years ago to some people, and the idea was floated, and I was saying, you know, the odd thing is, if we did this in England, it wouldn't really generate that much interest. It will generate a lot more interest and outrage in America than it would in England, because England is so thoroughly browbeaten and taken over by the left establishment in the media. It put the idea into my head, and as a result of that, we just carried it out. You know, we thought, here we are, we're in the European Union elections. We're standing here. There are potential voters in Winchester. Let's go and do it. Let's put our name on the map and hopefully show how far we've sunk, that you could be arrested in this country for quoting Winston Churchill. I mean, if you said that to someone 30 years ago, they would say it's just impossible. But
so you expected to be arrested?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did you expect that it would be impossible for the CPS?
I thought that given enough publicity, because clearly it was always going to generate publicity, the CPS would be reluctant to do it. But I didn't know that they weren't going to do it. And, you know, I also think it would generate a great deal more publicity if they actually locked you up for it. And I don't particularly object to that either.
Right. OK, so I mean, a public reading, as a point of law, a public reading couldn't be regarded as hate speech.
I think that it's the 2006 religious hatred that they brought in to get Griffin after they couldn't get him for the racial hatred thing, isn't it? And if somebody is offended by it, then it does become by default a racial religious incitement incident. And I think that they would probably have progressed that if the media had not got involved in it, but it became hugely embarrassing for them, and it was hugely embarrassing for them simply for arresting me. To actually lock me up for it would have created too much international outrage, because America carries some weight, and you know they were never going to do it. But again, you know, I don't consider myself to be a politician. You know, what we're doing, what we're all doing, is counter-revolutionary or revolutionary, and you do not come across many revolutionary people who attain power who have not at some stage in their revolutionary time spent some time in the nick. No, you just don't. And I think that again comes with the territory, and probably at some point they will lock me up for something. But again, you know, you take it on the chin. You know, these bastards out there have declared war on us, and you cannot just lie down in front of them. And so many people, but even in the EDL, you know, the EDL is not as big as it was, and they say, well, you know, we come out, we do these things, we get locked up, we lose our jobs. It's very difficult for us to do it. Listen, I'm sorry, but if you really want to do it, if you really believe in it, you have to take it. You have to take it on the chin, and you have to go to jail. If that's the threat they've got over you, you just say to them, fuck it, lock me up.
We are battling evil in that way.
We are, and I think it will progressively ratchet down on this harder and harder.
Yes, indeed. Well, nationalism is in crisis in general at the moment, and the people who oppose it know this too. They're very pleased about that, I have no doubt. They think that they have won. But you don't think that. You're trying to bring something together again. I'm most impressed with what you've done to date. I think that you're a tremendous breath of fresh air, and I will watch your progress with the most intense interest, Paul, and when I can give you the tiny bits of support I do online at the DT or wherever you pop up that I happen to be around, then I will do that unstintingly, and I wish you the very best of luck.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on to this as well. I know that you have a large following over at Majority Right, so
we used to it's less than it was, but it'll be all the greater for my talking to you.
It's been a privilege and an honor talking to you both. Thank you.